Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In eastern Ukraine, a reported Russian missile attack on a railway station that's killed dozens of civilians, including children, has been immediately condemned by the UN. In a statement on Friday, Amin Awad, who represents the UN Secretary-General in Ukraine, said that many suffered terrible injuries at Kramatorsk railway station and that the number of fatalities was likely to rise. It was widely reported over the last 2 days that the station and surrounding area had been full of civilians attempting to flee intensifying hostilities, Mr. Awad said in a statement, adding that he was extremely disturbed by reports that children, women, the elderly and people with disabilities were caught up in the attack. As conflict shifts to Ukraine's eastern oblasts, UN humanitarians appealed for local ceasefires so that civilians could escape the violence and to get life-saving aid in. 6 weeks since the Russian invasion, thousands of civilians are believed to be still trapped in the southern port city of Mariupol, where they faced weeks of heavy shelling. But there is still no truce agreement between Russian and Ukrainian forces to let them escape safely. Here's Jens Laka from UN Aid Coordination Office, OCHA.
He said top priority of that is to get silencing of the guns in those cities, with Mariupol being the worst affected, those cities where civilians are trapped, to allow them to get to safety voluntarily to a place of their choosing and to allow aid to get in. So this is an incremental process.
Since the Russian invasion began on the 24th of February, more than 4.3 million people have fled Ukraine, according to the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. More than 100 attacks on healthcare have also been verified, killing 73 and injuring 51. The war in Ukraine has also added to fears of skyrocketing global food prices, as the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, warned that its food price index had made a giant leap to its highest level ever since opening in 1990. FAO said that the export disruptions since the Russian invasion of Ukraine had led to a near 20% jump in cereal prices. To soften the impact on nations that import most of their food needs from both countries, 80 FAO members have appealed for the creation of a $25 billion fund to help them in the short term. Finally, to the Sahel and West Africa, where the number of hungry people has quadrupled in the last 3 years to reach 41 million. Issuing the alert, the UN World Food Programme, WFP, said that the figure rose even higher to 43 million if the Central African Republic was included in the food insecurity estimate. The problem is not limited to rural areas, as 16 million people live in urban spaces that are at risk of acute food insecurity. And WFP also warned that some 6 million children are undernourished in the Sahel. There are many reasons for the unprecedented food emergency in the Sahel and West Africa region, from conflict and displacement to climate shocks and inflation, made worse by the Ukraine crisis. According to WFP, prices have already increased between 30 and 50% in many places and even doubled in markets since the Russian invasion. Farmers are already deeply concerned about the next harvest after poor returns last year because of drought. WFP warned that they don't have enough food to cover their needs and that conflicts are escalating, and more than 6 million people have had to leave their homes in the Sahel. To provide life-saving help for the next 6 months, WFP urgently needs $777 million. Daniel Johnson, UN News. Hello. First, we heard that cluster weapons had been used in residential areas of Ukraine. Now there are reports that civilians have been run over by tanks while trying to flee Russian troops in Bucha. We'll hear more from the UN Rights Office on what steps it's taking to verify those claims on a day when the General Assembly decided to suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council. The war in Ukraine has also caused a food crisis for hundreds of millions of people in the Middle East and North Africa, the UN Children's Fund tells us, and it's also issued an alert about unrelenting violence in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo that's forced thousands of families to flee their homes. That's all coming up in this week's show, with closing comments too from Solange Behetege-Cortez. Stay tuned to hear the powerful Ukrainian war poetry that she's found. First, the news. The war in Ukraine has increased the risk of a massive malnutrition crisis for millions of children in other emergencies because of its already huge impact on global food prices, the UN said on Thursday. Also late on Thursday, the UN General Assembly voted to suspend Russia from the UN Human Rights Council over reports of gross and systematic violations and abuses of human rights by Russian troops who'd invaded Ukraine. There were 93 votes in favour, 24 against and 58 abstentions. This is only the second time a country has been suspended from the world's premier rights forum. Libya was the first in 2011. 6 weeks since Russia invaded Ukraine, the UN Children's Fund UNICEF said that imports had been disrupted to the Middle East and North Africa, where more than 90% of food has to be shipped in. Prices have also risen for essentials, including wheat, cooking oil and fuel. And if the situation continues, it will severely impact children, especially in Egypt, Lebanon, Libya, Sudan, Syria and Yemen. According to UNICEF, less than 4 in 10 young children in the Middle East and North Africa get the diets they need for growth and proper development. Meanwhile, inside Ukraine, new satellite images have confirmed that the destruction of cities besieged by Russian forces is ongoing. According to high-definition photographs produced by the UNISAT service, damage to Mariupol increased by about 6% between the 26th of March and the 3rd of April. Much of this increase was in the coastal harbour and steel mill areas, UNISAT said in its latest update. Desperately needed food aid reached Ethiopia's Tigray region for the first time in months earlier this week. It's a major development because hundreds of thousands of people are close to famine, and it comes after a ceasefire was agreed in late March between federal authorities in Addis Ababa and forces loyal to Tigrayan separatists. The truce, which follows nearly 17 months of brutal conflict in northern Ethiopia, means that fuel tankers have been able to reach regional capital Mekele, the World Food Programme, or WFP, said. The UN agency tweeted that more than 47,000 litres of fuel were busy refueling aid vehicles so that relief can reach the most vulnerable communities. The UN agency noted, however, that some 200,000 litres of fuel is needed every week to meet humanitarian needs in the region. Finally, to Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, where armed groups have continued to terrorize families, forcing thousands to flee for their lives. In an alert on Thursday, UN Children's Fund UNICEF said that conditions are dire and deteriorating at Ro refugee camp in Ituri province, where people are effectively trapped on a remote hill. The camp is home to more than 60,000 people, more than half are children. Many arrived last November after being driven from another camp in the town of Drodro that was attacked by men wielding machetes. This, UNICEF explained, was just one of the latest bouts of violence that have plagued Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo for decades, displacing around 5 million people. In an appeal for help to end the insecurity, UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell warned that there have already been outbreaks of respiratory illnesses, diarrhea and malaria. Every effort should be made to strengthen service delivery for people sheltering at the road camp and to protect them from violence, she said. The headlines there, and now to this week's interview, which takes us to the heart of what it means to be a UN human rights officer. As far as the Bucha atrocities are concerned, a huge amount of information and testimonies will be gathered, processed and stored, ultimately perhaps also sent to a court where judges will have to decide on the guilt or innocence of those individuals deemed to be responsible for their part in the killings. To tell us more, here's Liz Throssell from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights now.
The pictures, the footage that have emerged from Bucha are truly horrific and I think have shocked so many. Indeed, the High Commissioner herself spoke about how horrifying these images were. We're talking about possible war crimes. Now, what is interesting is that the High Commissioner last week spoke about possible war crimes committed both by Russian and Ukrainian forces. Now, that was in the context of heavy bombardment of urban areas, the destruction of civilian houses, buildings, schools, hospitals. Those may be possible war crimes. But of course, these could be taking place in a military context. What we've seen in Bucha is, of course, dead bodies in the streets. People with their hands tied behind their back. We've seen bodies of partially clothed women that have been burned. Now, these images are so shocking and so disturbing that they do strongly suggest that these people, these civilians, were directly targeted and were directly killed. Now, of course, work needs to be done to establish if a specific incident was a war crime. But what is clear is that under international law, the deliberate killing of civilians is a war crime.
So you have a human rights team in Ukraine, in Kyiv, I understand, in the capital. What are their plans to get to Bucha to see for themselves and to start the really forensic process that's involved in saying whether there has been a war crime?
Indeed, we have a presence in Ukraine that has in fact been there since 2014, based in the capital Kyiv, but also in other locations in the country. As of now, the majority of the team are based in the far west of the country in a place called Uzhgorod. They have a team of some 37 human rights officers based there. Now, what colleagues are aiming to do is to get to locations like Bucha to see for themselves what may have happened, and also importantly and crucially, talk to victims and talk to witnesses. This is crucial human rights work to get first-hand information to help establish what may have happened. It's painstaking work, of course, and it is work that needs to be conducted very carefully, because the cardinal principle of human rights work, of course, is to do no harm, is to avoid re-traumatizing people. And clearly they are likely to be speaking to people who have either suffered or witnessed unimaginable sights. So colleagues are looking to get there as soon as feasible. We think it is very important that information is gathered and collected as part of our overall work, monitoring and corroborating civilian casualties. But as one colleague said to me, it's not just about counting the numbers. It's not about counting figures. Every single number is a human being, is an individual, and it is important that what happened to them, where, how, is recorded. And this forms part of a wider effort by the UN, of course, by the international community, maybe by national courts, to pursue accountability in the courts for the perpetrators of these horrors.
I suppose what you've just said there will be of some reassurance to victims' families, but horrifying for them to have to digest the fact that, as you said, the victims appeared to have been targeted by those who killed them, and this is in an area which has only recently left by Russian forces. What do you say, though, to the Russian government official claim that this is all faked?
Well, I think that the first response is the main thing here is, of course, that there's investigations into what happened. But what we've also seen, of course, is multiple media reports emerging from Bucha and other areas, with journalists cataloguing, describing what has happened. This underscores the important role that journalists play in bringing information to light. It is important that there is accountability. It's important that there are investigations, and all steps need to be taken to identify the perpetrators of these crimes. So first of all, there needs to be investigations, but also we have seen so many different images and footage emerging from places like Bucha that is so, so concerning. And as I said, the brutality of what happens to these bodies is so concerning that it really, really does raise concerns that people were targeted. And as I said, under international law, the direct targeting and killing of civilians is a war crime.
Thank you, Liz. Can you just explain to listeners and to me where the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights work fits into the international justice system?
Of course, there are many bodies. We are the UN Human Rights Office, and the work we do is varied, but a principal part of that, of course, is the monitoring of civilian casualties. And that's important to stress. We only count those civilians who were killed in hostilities. The work that we do, the information that we gather, is part of a wider effort. Of course, as you say, there is the Human Rights Council that has recently appointed the Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine that is going to also play a very important role in gathering evidence and producing reports and pursuing accountability. We have the other courts, the International Court of Justice, and of course the International Criminal Court that has already opened investigations into possible war crimes. We have formal agreements with bodies such as the ICC. We also work with national courts and prosecutors. So there is a well-established framework. And of course, we are ready to apply our processes should it be so required. Because however horrifying, however disturbing what is happening in Ukraine is, we have seen this kind of incident before in other parts of the world.
And just to talk about the other parts of the world, Some commentators are saying that there's a growing weariness with the way that the war in Ukraine is dominating the headlines because, as you've just said, there are so many other crises elsewhere. What would you say to them?
We have a worldwide mandate, and the High Commissioner and her staff monitor human rights abuses and violations around the world, speak up for victims around the world. And it is obvious and it is clear and should never be forgotten that there are crises in other parts of the world. One can think of the long-running conflict in Syria that captured the media's attention in the early 2011 to maybe 2014 and has to some degree fallen out of the headlines. I think it is part of our role and, of course, of the wider UN to make sure that such crises are not forgotten. And, of course, the ideal would be, first of all, that there are no such emergencies. But, of course, there are. We have to be realistic. We live in the real world. So that, of course, that the UN really strives not to just focus on one part of the world, but to ensure that conflicts and suffering in all parts of the world are addressed. And I think the message from the Human Rights Office and from the High Commissioner is that at its very heart, at its very fundament, is respect for human rights, because without respect for human rights, conflict, violence and suffering will continue. And that may sound rather idealistic, but it is something that we continue to work for and strive for.
Many thanks to Liz Throssell from the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, in Geneva for explaining how justice and accountability happen after the kinds of atrocities that we've been seeing in Bucha. Now, to wrap up the show, here's regular guest Solange Behetege-Cortez with some closing comments and voices from Ukraine. Hi, Sol.
Hola, Daniel. The images of civilians tortured and murdered in Bucha are a terrible reminder that, as Liz Throssell from the UN Human Rights Office said, we've seen these images in other parts of the world. Sad wars, sad weapons, shooting bullets, not words. Images are a language. But what happens to language in a wartime? The Ukrainian poet Anastasia Afanasieva writes in the first person plural, we. It's a way of showing us how the occupation of a country affects all citizens, no matter which language they speak. Here's one of her poems now. When a four-wheeler with a mortar passed down the street, we didn't ask who we are. Whose side are you on? We fell down on the floor and lay there. Another Ukrainian author, Ludmila Hiersonska, sees her own body watching the war around her. She writes, buried in a human neck, a bullet looks like an eye, sewn in. And Katerina Kalitko from Vinnytsia sees also war as a physical body. War often comes along and lies down between you like a child, afraid to be left alone. How to write poetry in a country on war? Poetry will certainly change after the horror. We will change. As the Nobel Prize winning poet and author of The Witness of Poetry, Zeslav Miloš, said, not because we witness it, but because it witnesses us.
Thank you, Sol. Desperate lines there from Ukrainian poets Anastasia Afanasieva, Lyudmila Kazonska, Katerina Kalitko, and Polish author Zeslav Miloš. Words for War is where you can find those Ukrainian poets' work and new poems from Ukraine, and it was only printed in 2017, so it should still be in print and available. Thank you so much for listening and following the work of the UN, listeners. We really do appreciate it. We'll be back next week. I hope you'll join us. Bye-bye for now.
Ciao, Daniel.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The war in Ukraine has increased the risk of a massive malnutrition crisis for millions of children in other emergencies because of its already huge impact on global food prices, the UN said on Thursday. 6 weeks since Russia invaded its neighbour, the UN Children's Fund UNICEF said that imports have been disrupted to the Middle East and North Africa, where more than 90% of food has to be shipped in. Prices have also risen for essentials, including wheat, cooking oil and fuel. And if the situation continues, it will severely impact children, especially in Egypt, Lebanon, Libya, Sudan, Syria and Yemen, UNICEF said. Adel Koder, who's UNICEF's regional director for the Middle East and North Africa, warned that families are unable to cope with unprecedented food price hikes caused by ongoing conflicts, political instability, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the war in Ukraine. According to UNICEF, less than 4 in 10 young children in the Middle East and North Africa get the diets they need to grow and develop properly. Meanwhile, inside Ukraine, new satellite images have confirmed that the destruction of cities besieged by Russian forces is ongoing. According to high-definition photographs provided by the UNISAT service, damage to Mariupol increased by about 6% between the 26th of March and the 3rd of April. Much of this increase was in the coastal harbour and steel mill areas, UNISAT said in its latest update. Satellite footage from Bucha, where hundreds of Ukrainian civilians have been found killed following the withdrawal of Russian troops, shows that just over a quarter of the city has been badly damaged. To Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC now, where armed groups have continued to terrorize families, forcing thousands to flee for their lives. In an alert on Thursday, UN Children's Fund UNICEF said that conditions are dire and deteriorating at Ro refugee camp in Ituri province, where people are effectively trapped on a remote hill. The camp is home to more than 60,000 people and more than half are children. Many arrived last November after being driven from another camp in the town of Drodro that was attacked by men wielding machetes. This, UNICEF explained, was just one of the latest bouts of violence that have plagued eastern DRC for decades and displaced around 5 million people. In an appeal for help to end the insecurity, UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell warned that there have been many outbreaks of respiratory illness, diarrhea and malaria already. Every effort should be made to strengthen service delivery for people sheltering at the Ro camp and to protect them from violence, she said. A wave of digitalization across all parts of the economy has transformed traditional industry in the last 20 years, but it has also increased the risk of inequality, the UN said on Thursday. In a new report on global innovation, the World Intellectual Property Organization, or WIPO, said that digital innovation quadrupled from the year 2000 to 2020. And in the last 5 years, for which data is available from 2016 to 2020, digital innovation patents grew an impressive 172% faster than all other filings. The sector covers artificial intelligence, or AI, predictive technologies, highly sophisticated automation, and big data, all creations that can spur economic growth when used alongside people and not instead of them. WIPO said that while these new digital innovations may help poorer countries to develop more quickly, others may miss out because they lack both the capital required to invest in the technology and the highly skilled workforce that is also required. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. A new low in the war in Ukraine has made headlines around the world this week, with the discovery that hundreds of civilians have been killed in the city of Bucha, in areas previously controlled by Russian troops. Early testimonies from survivors indicate that the victims were directly targeted and killed, according to the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, responding to claims from Russia that the incident's nothing more than fake news. Here's spokesperson Liz Throssell talking to UN News' Daniel Johnson.
It is indeed very important that UN leaders and others are calling for investigations. This is something that indeed the High Commissioner has highlighted. What we have seen emerging from places like Bucha are serious concerns about possible war crimes, grave breaches of international humanitarian law and human rights law. So I think in order to ensure accountability, in order to pursue truth and justice, it is really and clearly important that there be investigations into what happened in Bucha and, of course, in other locations.
Now, you've indicated that the events at Bucha, just outside Kyiv, mark a turning point in the case for war crimes. What do you mean by that exactly?
The pictures, the footage that have emerged from Bucha are truly horrific and I think have shocked so many. Indeed, the High Commissioner herself spoke about how horrifying these images were. We're talking about possible war crimes. Now, what is interesting is that the High Commissioner last week spoke about possible war crimes committed both by Russian and Ukrainian forces. Now, that was in the context of heavy bombardment of urban areas, the destruction of civilian houses, buildings, schools, hospitals. Those may be possible war crimes. But of course, these could be taking place in a military context. What we've seen in Bucha is, of course, dead bodies in the street, people with their hands tied behind their back. We've seen bodies of partially clothed women that have been burned. Now, these images are so shocking and so disturbing that they do strongly suggest that these people, these civilians, were directly targeted and were directly killed. Now, of course, work needs to be done to establish if a specific incident was a war crime. But what is clear is that under international law, the deliberate killing of civilians is a war crime.
So you have a human rights team in Ukraine, in Kyiv, I understand, in the capital. What are their plans to get to Bucha to see for themselves and to start the really forensic process that's involved in saying whether there has been a war crime?
Indeed, we have a presence in Ukraine that has in fact been there since 2014, based in the capital Kyiv, but also in other locations in the country. As of now, the majority of the team are based in the far west of the country in a place called Uzhgorod. They have a team of some 37 human rights officers based there. Now, what colleagues are aiming to do is to get to locations like Bucha to see for themselves what may have happened, and also importantly and crucially, talk to victims and talk to witnesses. This is crucial human rights work to get first-hand information to help establish what may have happened. It's painstaking work, of course, and it is work that needs to be conducted very carefully, because the cardinal principle of human rights work, of course, is to do no harm, is to avoid re-traumatizing people. And clearly they are likely to be speaking to people who have either suffered or witnessed unimaginable sights. So colleagues are looking to get there as soon as feasible. We think it is very important that information is gathered and collected as part of our overall work, monitoring and corroborating civilian casualties. But as one colleague said to me, it's not just about counting the numbers. It's not about counting figures. Every single number is a human being, is an individual, and it is important that what happened to them, where, how, is recorded. And this forms part of a wider effort by the UN, of course, by the international community, maybe by national courts, to pursue accountability in the courts for the perpetrators of these horrors.
I suppose what you've just said there will be of some reassurance to victims' families, but horrifying for them to have to digest the fact that, as you said, the victims appeared to have been targeted by those who killed them, and this is in an area which has only recently left by Russian forces. What do you say, though, to the Russian government official claim that this is all faked?
Well, I think that the first response is the main thing here is, of course, that there's investigations into what happened. But what we've also seen, of course, is multiple media reports emerging from Bucha and other areas, with journalists cataloguing, describing what has happened. This underscores the important role that journalists play in bringing information to light. It is important that there is accountability. It's important that there are investigations, and all steps need to be taken to identify the perpetrators of these crimes. So first of all, there needs to be investigations, but also we have seen so many different images and footage emerging from places like Bucha that is so, so concerning. And as I said, the brutality of what happened to these bodies is so concerning that it really, really does raise concerns that people were targeted. And as I said, under international law, the direct targeting and killing of civilians is a war crime.
Thank you, Liz. Can you just explain to listeners and to me where the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights work fits into the international justice system? Because people have this impression that the wheels of international justice turn very slowly.
Of course, there are many bodies. We are the UN Human Rights Office, and the work we do is varied, but a principal part of that, of course, is the monitoring of civilian casualties. And that's important to stress. We only count in our civilian casualty figures those civilians who were killed in hostilities. Now, there may have been other deaths. There may have been deaths of combatants. There may have been deaths of people who died of natural causes, if I may frame it that way. The work that we do, the information that we gather, is part of a wider effort. Of course, as you say, there is the Human Rights Council that has recently appointed the Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine that is going to also play a very important role in gathering evidence and producing reports and pursuing accountability. We have the other courts, the International Court of Justice, and of course the International Criminal Court that has already opened investigations into possible war crimes. We have formal agreements with bodies such as the ICC. We also work with national courts and prosecutors. So there is a well-established framework. And of course, we are ready to apply our processes should it be so required. Because however horrifying, however disturbing what is happening in Ukraine is, we have seen this kind of incident before in other parts of the world.
And just to talk about the other parts of the world, some commentators are saying that there's a growing weariness with the way that the war in Ukraine is dominating the headlines because, as you've just said, there are so many other crises elsewhere. What would you say to them?
We have a worldwide mandate, and the High Commissioner and her staff monitor human rights abuses and violations around the world, speak up for victims around the world. And it is obvious and it is clear and should never be forgotten that there are crises in other parts of the world. One can think of the long-running conflict in Syria that captured the media's attention in the early 2011 to maybe 2014 and has to some degree fallen out of the headlines. You can think of Tigray, which was also in the headlines, where there was so much violence and civilian suffering, and that has also fallen out of the headlines to a large degree in Western-based media. You can think about Yemen, which is almost the epitome of civilian suffering, where people are suffering not only conflict, but drought and food insecurity. I think it is part of our role and, of course, of the wider UN to make sure that such crises are not forgotten. And one of the challenges, particularly for our colleagues in the humanitarian sector, is to ensure that the funds necessary so they can do their work continue to come in. And I know that one colleague from the refugee agency has said precisely because of the demands on them, they're having to move people from one emergency to another. And of course, the ideal would be, first of all, that there are no such emergencies. But of course, there are. We have to be realistic. We live in the real world. So that, of course, that the UN really strives not to just focus on one part of the world, but to ensure that conflicts and suffering in all parts of the world are addressed. And I think the message from the Human Rights Office and from the High Commissioner is that at its very heart, at its very fundament, is respect for human rights, because without respect for human rights, conflict, violence and suffering will continue. And that may sound rather idealistic, but it is something that we continue to work for and strive for.
This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. In Ukraine, humanitarians said on Wednesday that hundreds of people have managed to reach safety after fleeing Mariupol, while there's also been condemnation for the killing of Lithuanian filmmaker Mantas Kvedaravičius, as he also tried to escape from the besieged city. In a statement, the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, said that it had led a convoy of buses and cars carrying more than 500 people to Zaporizhia on Tuesday and Wednesday. All those transported in the humanitarian convoy had fled Mariupol on their own, said the Red Cross, which warned that thousands more civilians were trapped inside the devastated coastal city. They continue to need safe passage out and for aid to come in, the Red Cross insisted, noting that it was ready to provide relief once concrete agreements and security conditions allow it. UNESCO, the UN educational, scientific and cultural body, said that Mr. Kvedaravičius had died in his car while he was driving out of Mariupol at the weekend. He was 45. The filmmaker gained praise from critics for his documentary, Mariupolis, which screened at the Berlin International Film Festival in 2016. UNESCO Director General Audrey Azoulay denounced the killing and called for those responsible for his death to be identified and brought to trial in the interest of justice, freedom of expression and artistic freedom. The number of new COVID-19 infections has decreased for a second consecutive week, with a 16% decline worldwide in the last seven-day recording period, the UN Health Agency has said. The number of coronavirus deaths also decreased sharply by 43% compared to the previous week. Across the world, there were more than 9 million new cases and over 26,000 new deaths reported, and all regions have shown decreasing trends both in new cases and new deaths. WHO's COVID portal has registered more than 490 million coronavirus cases and over 6 million deaths. Health emergencies that are caused by climate change are on the rise in Africa, the World Health Organization, or WHO, said on Wednesday. Citing new data analysis, the UN agency said that the emergencies accounted for more than one in two public health events across the continent over the past two decades. of more than 2,100 public health alerts in the African region between 2001 and 2021, 56% were climate-related, and there were 25% more climate-related events in the decade following 2011 than there were in the previous 10 years, WHO said. To address the growing dangers of human-induced climate change, the UN Health Agency urged governments to prioritize human well-being in all key decisions, end fossil fuel mining and subsidies, tax polluters, and implement WHO air quality guidelines. Daniel Johnson, UN News. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Chief Antonio Guterres on Tuesday added his voice to growing international calls for a war crimes investigation into the killing of civilians in the Ukrainian town of Bucha. The Secretary-General's comments came after shocking images from Bucha on the outskirts of Kyiv showed hundreds of dead people, some with bullet wounds and their hands tied behind their backs, and others burned or in mass graves in areas previously under the control of Russian troops. Mr. Guterres told the UN Security Council that an independent probe was needed to guarantee effective accountability. In Geneva, the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, explained that the episode marked a new low in the war, with victims' bodies desecrated in death. OHCHR spokesperson Liz Throssell said that all the signs were that the victims were directly targeted and killed.
It's hard to see what was the military context of an individual lying in the street with a bullet to the head or having their body burned.
To Sri Lanka, where the UN Rights Office on Tuesday urged authorities to defuse tensions peacefully after a state of emergency was declared in response to protests over the country's deep economic crisis. In the capital Colombo and beyond, people's concerns have been rising in recent months amid soaring costs for basic goods linked to a lack of foreign currency caused by COVID restrictions. The UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, said that the situation had worsened and that there have been shortages of food and fuel along with power cuts, prompting new protests by desperate Sri Lankans. Citing reports of excessive and unwarranted police violence against protesters, the UN Rights Office also said that social media networks had been shut down for 15 hours. Any use of emergency measures by the state must comply with international human rights law, said OHCHR, its statement coming after UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet in February pointed to Sri Lanka's worrying drift towards militarization. Desperately needed food aid has reached Ethiopia's Tigray region, where hundreds of thousands of people are close to famine, UN humanitarians have confirmed. The development comes after a ceasefire was agreed in late March between federal authorities in Addis Ababa and forces loyal to Tigrayan separatists. The truce, which follows nearly 17 months of brutal conflict in northern Ethiopia, mean that fuel tankers have been able to reach regional capital Mekelle, the World Food Programme, or WFP, said. In a tweet at the weekend, WFP said that more than 47,000 litres of fuel were busy refueling aid vehicles so that relief can reach the most vulnerable communities. The UN agency noted, however, that 200,000 litres of fuel are needed every week to meet humanitarian needs in the region. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Madam President, Excellencies, the war in Ukraine is one of the greatest challenges ever to the international order and the global peace architecture founded on the United Nations Charter, because of its nature, intensity, and consequences. We are dealing with a full-fledged invasion on several fronts of one member state of the United Nations, Ukraine, by another, the Russian Federation, a permanent member of the Security Council, in violation of the United Nations Charter, and with several aims, including redrawing the internationally recognized borders between the two countries. The war has led to senseless loss of life, massive devastation in urban centers, and the destruction of civilian infrastructure. I will never forget the horrifying images of civilians killed in Bucha, and I immediately called for an independent investigation to guarantee effective accountability. And I'm also deeply shocked by the personal testimony of rapes and sexual violence that now are emerging. The High Commissioner for Human Rights has spoken of possible war crimes, grave breaches of international humanitarian law, and serious violations of international human rights law. And the Russian offensive has also led to the displacement of more than 10 million people in just 1 month, the fastest forced population movement since the Second World War. Far beyond Ukraine's borders, the war has led to massive increases in prices of food, energy and fertilizers, because Russia and Ukraine are linchpins of these markets. It has disrupted supply chains and increased the cost of transportation, putting even more pressure on the developing world. Many developing countries are already on the verge of debt collapse due to the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and the lack of adequate liquidity and debt relief, stemming ultimately from the unfair nature of our global economic and financial system. For all these reasons, it is more urgent by the day to silence the guns. That is why I ask the Emergency Relief Coordinator, Martin Griffiths, to travel to Russia and Ukraine to press for an urgent humanitarian ceasefire. And the Secretary General Griffiths will update you on the humanitarian situation and the results of his contacts so far. And the Secretary General Di Carlo will also brief you on the political and human rights dimensions. But as Secretary General of the United Nations, it is my duty to call the attention of the Council to the serious damage being done to the global economy and particularly to vulnerable people and developing countries. Madam President, our analysis indicates that 74 developing countries with a total population of 1.2 billion people are particularly vulnerable to spiking food, energy and fertilizer costs. Debt obligations take up some 16% of developing countries' export earnings, and in small island developing states, the figure is 34% and rising because of increased interest rates and the need to pay for expensive imports. In the past months alone, wheat prices have increased by 22%, maize by 21%, and barley by 31%. Brent oil prices on the 1st of April were more than 60% higher than at the same time last year. A series of events have led to that, not only the present situation. Natural gas and fertilizer prices more than double over the same period. We are already seeing some countries move from vulnerability into crisis and signs of serious social unrest. The flames of conflict are fueled by inequality, deprivation, and underfunding. With all the warning signals flashing red, we have a duty to act. Madam President, the Global Crisis Response Group on Food, Energy and Finance that I set up last month has formulated some initial recommendations for the consideration of member states, international financial institutions and others. On food, we are urging all countries to keep markets open, resist unjustified and unnecessary export restrictions, and make reserves available to countries at risk of hunger and famine. This is not the time for protectionism. Humanitarian appeals must be fully funded. People caught up in crises around the world cannot pay the price for this war. On energy, the use of strategic stockpiles and additional reserves could help ease this energy crisis in the short term. But the only medium and long-term solution is to accelerate the deployment of renewable energy, which is not impacted by market fluctuations. These will allow the progressive phase-out of coal and other fossil fuels, and renewables are already cheaper in most of the cases. And on finance, international financial institutions must go into emergency mode. We need urgent action by the G20 and international financial institutions to increase liquidity and fiscal space so that governments can provide safety nets for the poorest and most vulnerable. The reform I've been calling for the global financial system is long overdue. All these actions are closely linked with the prevention agenda and with building and sustaining peace. Madam President, the war in Ukraine must stop now. We need serious negotiations for peace based on the principles of the United Nations Charter. This Council is charged with maintaining peace and doing so in solidarity. I deeply regret the divisions that have prevented the Security Council from acting not only on Ukraine, but on other threats to peace and security around the world. I urge the Council to do everything in its power to end the war and to mitigate its impact, both on the suffering people of Ukraine and on vulnerable people and developing countries around the world and I thank you.